No problem.
Okay, folks, can we start? Yeah, it is actually working. So before I start the lecture proper, I thought it was a good idea for you to hear a little bit about WebCT. How many of you have used WebCT before? Or you all kind of know about it? So that won't take very long then. Shariar was going to show you what we've got on WebCT for Informatics 1. How many of you looked at for Informatics 1 on WebCT before? Well, actually, quite a lot of you. So there may be very little to be said. Anyway, just to be absolutely sure, because it is a very nice resource, and I wouldn't want anybody not to have it. So, sure, you need to wire yourself up with this.
Okay. Then probably, as you know, you can access WebCT from your MyEd. You have this link here. And here is what you see. So there are some links on WebCT of this course, a brief guide to the informatics, which is a link to the Informatics 1 web page. And there are two parts in this course, which is logic and computation. In each part, you can see a brief notes on logics and computation. It's a sort of abstractions of your node. It's not instead of your node, but it might help you just as a reminder. For example, here you can see some basics about your truth table and how truth table can be constructed. More importantly, apart from these links, which are some notes, there is a part. Oh, let me bring it. Which is called assessments. There are some extra exercises on different topics on computation and logic. Some of them are active now, and when you go through the course, some other exercises will be activated and you can use them. You can these are extra exercises, and they're different from your tutorials, so it might help you to understand better. And if you have any question or problem with these exercises, you can contact me. For example, this is the truth table exercise. If you begin your assessment, there are four questions about truth table. Yeah, that's interesting. So, there are four questions. There are different questions. You can answer them and then save your answers. You could see the results. If you have any problem, you can pop me an email or ask a question. One important point about your tutorials. There was some confusion about the dates on tutorial and the course homepage, probably for some students and tutors. I've changed the dates of tutorials and on the PDF files and on the website. The dates were the releasing date of the tutorial. Now the new dates are the dates that you have tutorial classes. So for this week, which is week 3, you have tutorial 1. And next week, which is week 4, you have tutorial number 2. That's all.
Thanks, Sharia. Right, now, a moment's intermission while I do my stuff and get rid of this. Okay, here we go. A couple more bits of administrative stuff before we start. One, you can see, if you want to see the videos for this lecture series, they go up one at a time, pretty reasonably close to when I actually give them. So you have to have a little pause, and then shortly after I give the lecture, you can find them. There's where you go. You might want to take a note of that. I don't think this one is linked from the website yet. I'll maybe ask Chariar to do that. But You can jot it down now if you want to get straight onto it. Actually, some of you maybe already kind of had this thought. There's a 2011 in there. Actually, you could find the lectures for last year as well if you want. You can do if you want to relive what the people who are now in second year, their experience of doing this last year. You can do that. All you need is 2010. And if you want to do the year before, you can do 2009. You know, there's no shortage of different ways of looking at this particular course. So, and of course, you don't have to look at it at all if you don't want to. Although, in the past, the videos have been pretty popular, I have to say. We do find them downloaded quite a bit. So I think it is quite a useful thing to be able to do. Right, so that's that. Oh, one more thing. Paper. You should find, I hope there's enough there. It looks like quite a small pile to me, but I hope there's enough copies of the lecture slides here, because remember before I was asking, did you want paper or not? Most people said you want paper, so there's a pile of paper there with the lecture slides in.
Are they online as well?
They're online as well, yes. So you can, all of this, oh, let me say that again. I mentioned this before, but just to remind you. So all of the lecture slides are online now, including the ones I've yet to give. And so that's, so the ones I've yet to give are kind of a guess. So I might change them on the way through. They're going to be approximately correct. So I think it's quite good to have them up front and to give you them as paper, because people sometimes like to write little annotations. And I'll try not to make them so far different from the ones that are on the web. But I do reserve the right to change the slides and so on as I go through if there's something that comes up, actually. In fact, I know, or I'm pretty sure, actually, that the slides I use for the lecture tomorrow will be a little bit different, because I'm going to include a little bit more on some of the laws for equivalence in those slides. So, I mean, things can change a little bit, but broadly they'll be the same, and it's to your advantage, I think, to see as much as possible of the course ahead of time as you can. You don't need to use it, but it's there if you want to, and kind of peek ahead and see things. Okay, so, lecture today is negation. Really what I'm doing is just taking, remember the secant calculus proofs that we started in the last lecture. I hope you've had time to have a look at those a little bit in the week that's passed between when I gave that lecture and now. And I hope you remember a little bit about what a secant calculus proof is. I'm not going to spend a lot of time recovering that again, because that's just wasteful of time. All I'm going to do this time, technically, really, is just extend that a little bit, and in a way that enables me to talk about negation, enables me to talk about doing proofs where what you're doing is making constructive use of things not being true, which is something we haven't really done very much of before. But I'll also do the usual thing that I always do. I'll start off with a little problem, and then we'll come back and solve it. And the problem I'm going to choose is perceptrons. I chose this one because it's a slightly unusual one to be talking about when you're talking about logic. So because it touches on neural systems. There's a kind of many different ways of getting a system to do something that's useful for you, and one way is the way I've been mostly describing things just now. You very precisely describe up front a model of what the system is. And you take your logic, let's say, or actually the same would be true if you were using some other non-logical language, and you describe what are the rules that you use to solve a problem. Another way is to try and solve problems simply based on many, many examples, experience, things that you see. And things like brains are, as far as we know, systems that are very well adapted to solving problems that way. You know, we see examples. We have a structure inside our brain where it's very, very difficult to spot what the rule is. There's nobody is claiming that somehow internally in the structure of our brains there is directly encoded rules or logical axioms. What you've got is some mess of connections, and somehow through that mess of connections and all the experience you get, certain amount of hardwiring, but also quite a lot of experiential learning, you get complex behaviors. So that's a rather different thing to model. And what I'm going to do is say a little bit about the very simplest way that you can think about those things. And of course, the field is much more complicated. And link it a little bit into logic. Were any of you At Rick Rashid's talk yesterday, you got some of you were. So if you were at that talk, you'd have got a little bit. So Rick Rashid is the he was across giving a talk here yesterday. He's the director of research for Microsoft, a big part of his talk for people who weren't there was to talk about the difference in emphasis where you're building systems that are very data driven versus systems where you're trying to encode internally to the system, you know, the entirety of how you solve the problem. He wasn't talking about neural systems on the whole. He was talking about probabilistic Bayesian systems, which we touch on a little bit later in the course. Okay, so for perceptrons, what you want to do is you want to have some system that's a big structure that contains lots and lots of units that individually look very, very similar, but when you kind of join them together, they give you this behavior that they can be learned, they can be trained from examples, and their behavior can become reliable. So kind of the simplest example of that kind of individual unit is a perceptron. The perceptron is just a little component that you have in your system, and it takes a number of inputs. That's the I1 to IN on this diagram. And it takes a threshold value. What that threshold value is going to, it produces an output. So one output, lots of inputs. So you have stimulus coming into the inputs. So they're kind of on or they're off. And you want the output to either go on or off. So you've got these little components. Inputs activated, does the output activate? So very, very simple component. The threshold is really going to is a value that's going to tell you how much input it's going to take to produce the output. How likely is it to get stimulated? You could think of it that way. Each of these inputs has a weight, and what the weights intuitively are doing is telling you how much attention you pay to each one of the inputs. Right? So these things are weighted to give them a different strength. There's a threshold on this thing to give it a different propensity to activate. Okay, and then the output is going to be the threshold applied to all of the weights minus t, which is the threshold value. And threshold is going to give the th function here is going to give you zero if all of this is less than or equal to zero. And it's going to give you one if it's greater than zero. In other words, if the weighted inputs exceed the threshold, bang, right? That's the idea. Okay? Happy with that? So all of this is doing is implementing a thresholding function based on the weighted inputs. Right. I'm telling you a little bit about perceptrons because you need to understand it in order to do the other bit that we're going to get to. So here's how. There's a kind of basic model of how to train perceptrons. So they're usually trained from data. So you've got data on whatever it is that you're sampling from the environment. And that's what's supplying you the inputs to your perceptron. You just choose the threshold and weights randomly. Choose whatever you want for those. If the resulting behavior is what you want, it does what you need. You're giving it lots of examples. You choose threshold and weights, and then you see what it does. Suppose you're classifying faces in an image or something. You probably wouldn't use a single perceptron for that, but suppose you were. You give it lots of examples of faces, and you want to classify them as being, I don't know, male or female or something like that. And so you give lots of examples, and if it's giving you the right classification, you say, great, you stop. Your thresholds and your weights are just fine. If not, then what you do is if the output's too large, you multiply the input by a small constant, subtract that from the weight. And you do the same with the threshold. If the output's too small, then you add to the weights and you decrease the threshold. I don't want to go into why that's a particularly good thing to do. The nice thing about that is with the right sort of problem, that's convergent. Okay, so you just keep going like that until you hit the terminating condition. So then a question might be, and the question that we're going to look at a little bit is, could they ever give the behaviors that you get with a logical connector? So could you produce a perceptron that would give you logical ands and logical ors and things like that? Because that would be quite a nice thing to have.
Okay, so that's the
That's the question that we'll come back to at the very end. But before that, I mean, in some ways, this bit, I could have introduced that particular example in the previous lecture as well. So it's a sort of example to do with representing things and dealing with the sort of axioms that are natural to deal with in sequent calculus. Before we do that, I want to talk about negation. And to do that, I have to introduce essentially two new concepts for you. They're not absolutely new, but sort of they are. And the first one is this thing in here, which is the notion. Remember, I've been talking so far about sequence and sequence of axioms in them, so things like A's and B's and C's, or whatever it is you want to say, your atomic propositions, and the things that you build, the structures you build up that are connected from those using the logical connectors. Those are your axioms. And then you prove things from that, like A or B or C. So you can say A and A implies B, then does that prove B? Something like that. So I'm going to give you a couple more concepts now. And they're just really special propositions. So one special proposition, imagine that you have some proposition that's always true. Okay, you give it a special name. And that's a proposition that you can prove without having any axioms. It's just universally true. It's like later on when we start to talk about things like prologue in depth, we'll hit on that particular one. It's quite convenient to be able to say, once we've got to the end of our proof, there's some basal element which must always be true, okay, without any axioms, just a universal truth. And then imagine the dual of that, which is something that would always be false, a proposition that under all circumstances you would always believe false. Okay, and that's one that you couldn't prove from any of the axioms. So those two are like special propositions, and they're not tied to particular domains. They're just proposition, the universally true proposition, the universally false proposition that you would never ever believe. So I'm just introducing those concepts, a new little tiny extension. Okay. The other concept that I'm going to introduce to you is the notion of proof by absurdity, effectively. So we haven't really talked about it very much, but implicit in pretty much everything I've been doing and in everything that I will do in the rest of the course is the notion that when you've got a set of axioms that's describing a problem, that set of axioms is itself consistent. It doesn't contain inconsistency. You're not saying inside those set of axioms something is true and something is not true. Okay? The set of axioms that is internally consistent, then everything you're proving from that is true because all the axioms were consistent and you're developing a proof from that. And that's an assumption that you make with the sequent calculus normally. That actually leaves you open a kind of interesting style of proof, which is to say, if you have this notion of something that's universally false, then suppose I want to prove the negation of something. I want to prove from this set of axioms that something is not true. One way to do that is to say, okay, let me prove that from that I can generate the proposition that's universally false. And I'll do that by sticking A itself in as an assumption. So this is rather like a proof by absurdity. You say, okay, I want to be able to show you that A is not true. Let me show you that when I put A into my consistent set of axioms, I can generate universal falsehood. I can generate you this thing that is the one thing that we know is always false. In other words, I'm generating an absurdity when I put A in. Okay? Then I need something that's going to be able to deal with doing a proof by absurdity, which I don't have in any of the proof rules I showed you last time. You can go back and check. So here's the rule that allows you to do this. This one says, for my set of axioms, I can prove anything, B, if I can show you that I've got the negation of something, anything, in my set of axioms. I got a negation in there, and I can show you that from that set of axioms, I can prove the opposite. All right? So this is the absurd state. I show you that, and taking these two together, what's going on is I'm saying, okay, I can generate the absurdity here by putting A in. I've added something else in as an assumption to my consistent set
F. And now this one spots for me the inconsistency. Right? So what I'm doing is I'm saying, okay, intuitively what I'm doing is I'm saying, okay, folks, here's my consistent set of axioms. What you're saying about it is the following thing. Let me negate that for you and show you that to not believe it is absurd. Just generates you an absurdity. Bingo. Right? Which is that's a very human form of argument. It's quite a strong and persuasive form of argument. I lay out the axioms. I show you the thing that I don't want to hold true is absurd. Therefore, the thing that I do want to hold true must hold true. Right? Takes a little moment to kind of grasp that, but it is a very human style of argument.
Okay. This one is just housekeeping. So this is, if I want to prove A, I can prove it by having the negation of the negation. Let me show you a proof rule.
Oh, and most importantly, the little bit at the bottom of the slide, the purpose of this is actually to do a positive proof. I'm going to construct the proof tree that shows you that something is false. I'll show you, yeah.
I'm going to ask about the second rule. Mm-hmm. If you have any D, do A and B have to contradict themselves? I mean, do they have to be the opposite?
No. These two guys have to contradict themselves. What this says is, if I can show you a contradiction, I can prove anything at all. From a contradictory rule set of axioms, anything false, especially false. Okay.
So here's a proof that you wouldn't have been able to do with the previous set of sequent calculus rules. You will be able to do when you're using these ones. Plus, you could have used the other ones as well. This is the rules I've given you are an extension to the rule set that I gave you before.
So what we want to show here is if A is true and it's not true that A and B are true, then I want to be able to prove that B is not true. And maybe we should take a moment to look at this one intuitively. So you know, if I know that A and B can't both be true, I know that A is true, then I know that B can't be true. So it feels like we should be able to prove that intuitively, right? And then we need to think how. So how we do it is we say, okay, let's show that if we take the negation of B, the negation of not B, which is B itself. So let's put B in there. Let's just assume that B is true in our set of axioms now. And I'll show that that allows me to conclude absurdity. Now, I know that not A and B appears in here. Okay, so not A and B is, there it is. And now, what I want to be able to prove is that A and B is true, which, if you remember from the pre... Hmm?
Why do we write the point that not A and B belongs to B, A not...
Why do I need this? So that's because that's this proof,
uh-huh.
I'm applying this proof. Right? So that's the, this appears in, so not this appears in here, and now I need to prove this. So this is the negation and the non-negated one. These two are at variance. They can't both be true. Right? You agree, they can't both be true. It can't be true that A and B is not true, and A and B is true. Right? Another question.
Would it be at all helpful to rewrite not A and B as not A or not B, or is that not really true?
It doesn't help you for this one, because the proof is pretty direct. You could if you want. For this proof it doesn't help you, but for an alternative proof, if you want, that is an equivalence, and you might find it useful to use, but you don't need it for this one. Okay, so now what I have to do is to show that this holds, which it does, because A appears in there and B appears in there. Okay, so now I have my proof. And then if you read it, it says, I can show that not B holds from A and not A and B. If I can show that putting B, the negation of not B, in here generates
a negation, which is not A and B inside here, and I show that the opposite of that holds. Right. So it's a proof by absurdity. Right. Oh, sorry, these ones fit in. Okay,
so that's a proof by absurdity. There's another way of getting a negation, which is much more direct, but is a bit slippery. You need to be very careful how you use it in practice. The trouble with doing proofs by negation in the way that I described to you is they involve, they're quite subtle and slippery. I mean, people, when you were sitting witnessing this, listening to me talking about it, I could very easily tell that you're going, oh, wow, that's quite difficult to kind of get your head around and control and understand what we're doing when we're doing that kind of proof. It doesn't feel a very direct style of negation, although it is very effective.
Another way of doing it is to use what's called negation as failure. And for people who are familiar with logic programming languages like Prolog, that's the style that's used in those kind of languages.
And the trick is very kind of brutally straightforward in some ways. What we do is we realize that that we have a system of proof. That system of proof searches. It looks at, you can generate these proof trees for different expressions. There are a bunch of proof rules. You apply them, and then you look through them, you make your choices about how to do your proof.
You can take all of the previous negation rules we've got and say, we replace them as one rule. So I want to show the negation of something from my set of axioms. I just show, and I'm introducing a new symbol here for this, I show that no matter how hard I try applying all of the proof rules that I've got in all of the possible combinations in which they can be applied, I cannot find a proof of A. And if I can't do that using all the proof rules that I've got, assuming that the proof rules that I've got are sound and complete, big assumption, then it can't be true. Okay, so essentially you're saying if I can't find it, having tried all the permitted options for finding it, then it's false.
Can we do it the other way around? Like the F, like not A and A, swap and...
Yes. Is the answer because all you need is the negation. You're putting the negation in here. But let's not go there. Later on, I'll be talking a little bit more about how you do this in more detail when I talk about resolution, which is the basis for logic programming. So all I want to do now is to get you the idea of closed world negation. So later on, we talk about this in a lot more depth.
Okay. So for now, this just means that I can't find a proof of A from X.
The assumption this is making is what's called the closed world assumption. We're assuming that F contains all the axioms that's pertinent to the problem. In other words, we've described the problem completely. There's just two things. We're relying on this search failing. We're relying on looking for a proof and not finding one. And then there's two things that are bounding that search. One is what's in the axioms. What do they say? And so the big assumption is we said everything, right? And the other thing that bounds the proof is the actual search that we made, which was done according to the proof rules, right? We apply proof rules to construct these proof trees. And what we're saying is we constructed every one and there was no proof. So we're assuming that that actual search is complete. In other words, we have a complete set of, we have all of the proof rules that we need to establish any proof that we might ever want, and we applied them all exhaustively. So all of these are quite big assumptions, not necessarily true for all the proofs that we might want to do. But let me give you a closed world proof here. So I've introduced some variables here just to make it more interesting. And actually, for people who are interested in, who already know languages like Prolog, you could think of these as being like Prolog clauses. These are Prolog facts and these are Prolog rules. But we don't need to get into that just at the moment. So we're trying to show that not Q of C is true, given that I know P of A, P of B, and P of X implies Q of X. Right? So I know P is true for A, P is true for B, and I know P is true for A, and so this X is universally quantified. If I know that P is true for anything,
then Q is true for anything. And so you can see I could conclude Q of A, I could conclude Q of B, because I know P of A and P of B. But I won't be able to conclude Q of C from this. And this is what I'm really relying on. So the way the proof goes is, okay, let's try to prove Q of C, but I'm hoping to fail. This red cross means I hope to fail, right? Okay, so it's not like I hope to succeed. So I'm relying on this not working now. And if this doesn't work, then I know that this works, right? So let's see. And so then I exhaustively apply. You just have to trust me. I'm exhaustively applying the rules, right? I'm not going to go and look at all of the rules and tell you why I'm doing it exhaustively. So now I try to prove Q of C in the normal way using my normal prover on my sequent rules. And the only way I can really do it is using the implication here. So then I try to prove, and now I'm going to match the Q of C onto Q of X here. So P of C implies Q of C is in this because we've got P of X implies Q of X. So now I try to prove P of C. And I can't prove P of C because I haven't got P of C in here, and I have nothing else that's talking about P. Right, so there is no rule that I can apply because nothing allows me to prove P other than these two axioms, which are just atomic predicates. Right? So therefore, there is no proof here, so that doesn't work. So that then fails as well. That's not true. So that doesn't work. Whoops. So that does, right? So this red bit is meant to be the bits that don't work. So just to recap, I wanted to prove the negation. So then I took the negation of the thing I want to prove, Q of C here, and I'm relying on it failing, which it does when I search exhaustively. Therefore, I conclude that it must not have been true. Let me
give you an example. You may not like this example, but I wanted to give you a precise example of why this thing can really screw you up. And I wanted to show you how it can screw you up in ways that are kind of hard to predict ahead of time. So this is a kind of deliberately slippery example. It doesn't matter if you don't understand this bit. But just to give you an intuition for why it kind of screws you up in ways you might not have expected. So here's one. Suppose I know P of A and Q of B, and I want to demonstrate that P of X and not Q of X is true, right? So let's take the P of X first. So I'm going to it's an AND. So I to show that something and some and something else is true, I do the this thing, and I need to prove separately this thing, right? Normal rule. Okay. So P of A is in here. So I'm binding the P of A with the P of X. So P of A is true. Happy with that? That's good. Right. Now, notice the binding here. So X is bound to A. Happy with that? Let me step back. There was a little bit. See? Watch what happens to the x. So P of A is in here, and it's P of X I want, so that x must be an A. Blink, 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 right? Okay, so now I want to be able to show from P of A and Q of B that not Q of A is true. So I want to show that. So to do that, I use negation as failure. So can I find Q of A from this? So that fails, right? And that failing is enough to make that true. Hooray. Right? So the answer to this is true. Let's try it again. Okay, this is the same one that we had here. Here I'm showing you the variables. The only difference is that I've reversed the order of these. So I put the not QA first and the PA over here, right? All I've done is switch them around. Makes no difference. ANDs are completely symmetrical, right? A and B is the same as B and A, right? So this should make no difference. So now I'm going to try and establish it's not true Q of X. Okay. So from P of A and Q of B, I'm going to use that negation as failure. Right, question.
Yeah, when you swap the x, A for X, why did you do this with Q of X as there's a Q of B on the left hand side? Yeah,
so here's
so
Q of A.
Steps before, yeah.
Yeah, this one? This set?
The previous one on the top, yeah.
The one
you
on the top?
You swap the X for an A.
Yeah, okay. Oh, let me step back. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, here we are. So we want to say P of X and not Q of X. Okay, and so I say, okay, what can I establish the truth of P of X here from this? And the crucial step is this one where I say P of A is in here, a constant A. And what I'm doing is I'm saying, okay, P is true for, so P is not true for any arbitrary x, P is true for A. So P of A doesn't allow me to conclude that P is true for every x. Right? So,
but
that's what it is.
Does Q of A belong to the set of x?
Yes, it's the same x. It's the same x, right? So this is the same x. Right? Because that's the reason for having the names be significant in variables. If the names weren't significant in variables, then you'd never be able to identify one variable with another, and you'd never be able to do anything with your predicate logic, or actually even with your functional programs. Okay, so that's P of A.
So if you substitute A for X, you have to do it throughout the entire field?
That's the way I'm doing it here. You'll see this is going to create a problem for us, but it is the way it's done. Okay? So we did that. Right? Now I reverse the order. And I'm saying, is it not true that Q of X, because that's the left-hand side of the AND app. So now I want this to fail. But unfortunately, it succeeds. Because there is a Q of B. So that fails. So that fails. So that fails, which is a bit of a problem, because that was true and this is false. And you go, oh, that's kind of crap, because you don't really want your theorem prover to do that. And the reason is, I don't want to delve deep into the reasons for this, because this I'm teaching about propositional logic, not about logics that have to do with variables. But I do want you to be aware that some of the mechanisms that people use in proof only apply to limited cases for proof. And this is one of those where you're making the closed world assumption. So the reason this creates a problem is because when we do this particular bit of the proof, it doesn't just affect the search for the proof, but the bindings of the variables as well. Not a problem in propositional logic, but a problem in predicate logic. Once you start to extend your logic to include variables, then there are issues about the quantification of variables, how safe it is to perform a unification between two terms, to make them be the same, that can catch you up when you're trying to bound the proofs that you're doing using a closed world assumption. I do not expect you to understand what I said in the last 2 minutes. I just want you to understand that there are some limits to these kinds of proofs. And once you start to go beyond propositional into predicate logic, which you do once you start to do serious things with these logics, you hit these kinds of boundaries. So negation as failure is an excellent method that's used very, very extensively in programming languages, but it's a method that has its limitations. And once you get deeply into those programming languages, you start to, you actually find yourself fighting a little bit against that when you're writing programs. Okay, enough of that. And I'm running out of time. I have to go quickly through the perceptron one, but I do want to get this little bit done. This particular thing is going to, that when we solve this problem, we're going to use a little bit of negation, but the most important thing I want to give you an idea of is just how to represent, again, it's how to represent problems and understand them using logic. So here's our perceptron. We want to be able to figure out whether it's going to give us behavior like logical connectives. So I don't have to repeat what this is. Inputs, threshold, weights, output, like we had before. Happy you remember that from your memory span is good enough to last for 30 minutes. So there's different ways we could model this. I'll give you one way. I'm going to invent a predicate called weight, And what that's going to do is it's just going to define every weight that we're going to use. And I'm just going to choose minus 2 to 2. Okay, so I'm going to add weights from minus 2 to 2, and it's going to go out in steps of 0.1. So that defines all the possible weights that I'm going to allow. And I'm going to define thresholds the same way. Those are all the possible thresholds. So it's a discrete model of thresholds and weights. So if I say weight point minus 2, it means that's a legitimate weight that I can use. And I'm also going to define the inputs. So I'll say an input can be 0 or an input can be 1. So if I say input 0, it means it's a possible input. Now I'm going to define the behavior of the perceptron. And this, you can't, of course, remember verbatim what was on the previous slide, but more or less it is a verbatim translation. So what this says is I have a perceptron given the set of inputs, given the threshold, so I have a set of inputs and the threshold, and it will give me some output. If I can sum the weights of the input set to get S, so that's just going through the weights, summing them. And E is S minus the threshold. Remember, that was part of the equation. And here's the bit that does the thresholding. If E is less than or equal to 0, if E is less equal to 0 and the output is 0, or E is greater than 0 and the output is 1. Okay. So actually, for people who are interested, who are more functionally inclined, which you might be since you're doing the functional programming course, you could also think of this as being a function. O is the output of the function. I, S, and T are the input to the function. This is defining the function. But I have a relational language, and so then these inputs and outputs appear just as arguments to the predicate. More or less happy with that. Remember, you don't have to do this kind of thing for exams, but I do want you to understand what it's like to do this kind of thing, because it's what people often do with logic. Okay? Happy with that. Right. So now we're going to actually look at a truth table again. So here's our truth table for ands, ors, and nots. Remember that? If you can't remember that, you're in trouble. Go and learn truth tables for ands, ors, and nots. So that's how it's supposed to work. Here are all the possible input values, except instead of true and false, as we would normally have used in the truth table, I'm using zeros and ones. Think of zero as false and one as true, if you like. Two zeros, if it's an and, it becomes a zero. If it's an or, it's a zero, is that right? Yeah, because, and if it's not, it's a one for I1. If you've got a 0 and a 1, it's a 0 for an and, it's a 1 for an or, right? So it's just the truth tables.
These are the behaviors, then, that we want for these connectors. If the perceptron was behaving like an and or an or a not, then this is the behavior that we want to see. So in other words, it's a bit like when we're training our perceptron, this is how we want to see it behave. It relates. This is the desired output for an and is 0 if the inputs are like this. Okay, so I'll define that in my logic too. So required says that if I have an and connective, then if I have a 0 with whatever weight it is on one input and a 0 with whatever weight it is on the other input, then I want to see a 0. I actually don't care what W1 and W2 are, but I do want to be this 0 if one of the inputs is 0 and so is the other one. And I just do all the combinations here. So this required for an and is really doing that column in my truth table. And I've just defined it in my logic. So in some ways, it's quite a sophisticated thing we're doing here. I'm taking a truth table. I'm using a logic to define the logic of the truth table. But just that's one of the wonderful things about logic. You can do these kinds of things. OK, so now what I do is I define what it means to be a valid perceptron given a particular connector type, like and or whatever. And I say, OK, it's a valid perceptron. Here's the bit where I'm going to use negation. It's a valid perceptron with two weights for my two inputs, because all of my connectors have two. So I can just have a weight 1 and a weight 2, and a given threshold. If W1's a weight, W2's a weight, it's in the weight range, T is a threshold. Okay, so this thing actually is not acting really like a function. It really is a Boolean. It's saying, is this true or false?
I have my threshold, and it's not true that I have some input, I1, I2, and it behaves like a perceptron, which I defined before, and it's not true, so the negation inside there, that it's required. Let me give this to you intuitively. I'm saying I have a valid perceptron according to the logical connective if I can assign some weights and threshold to it, and it doesn't invalidate the way the perceptron's meant to behave. Dun, 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 dun. So that is indeed meant to turn your brain to jelly a little bit, because you're using two negations inside, and it's deliberately supposed to do that for you, and it will be very healthy, brain-wise, to go away and look at that example and think, why on earth could that actually really work? And I bet that if you spend about, you know, maybe a quarter an hour or something, you will convince yourself that that works in some strange way. Okay, and that's how it goes. Okay, we'll do the rest of the argument doesn't matter. We'll stop now. See you on Friday.
What should I do if my logic tutorial is at the same time as maths tutorial?
Go and talk to the IQ up on level 4 and they'll help you find another tutorial.
Okay.
Oh, that's okay. So
that one.
That'd probably be fine. And then back to that for okay.
Yeah. 4 and 1.
Okay, so do I need to open the PowerPoint thing first?
Well, the minute it's on laptop, you'll be using both.
Oh, right,
usually.
Okay.
I mean, this is if you were going to use the visualizer, you'd yeah. You'd do that. Are you going to be showing DVDs or anything?
No. So that would take me over to that. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's it's on both screens now. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you could, if you wanted to, you could have one different for one screen and one different for the other screen. But
So, do I open PowerPoint first and then put the stick in?
You could do either, to be honest.
You open one stick or open PowerPoint.
Probably better look at that.
Yeah, I am.